States threatens Nicaragua with sanctions after incumbent Daniel Ortega wins the Central American country's race for president. The Yemeni army's air defenses shoot down a spy drone over the Flashpoint province of Marib. And COVID on the surge in Europe. Several countries report record daily deaths amid a sharp rise in cases across the continent. Studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Incumbent Daniel Ortega winning Nicaragua's presidential election and clinching his fourth consecutive term in office. The Electoral Council says almost all ballots have been counted, and Ortega has won with over 76% of the votes. Ortega is hailing the results as a victory against terrorism and the enemies of Nicaragua. Washington and the European Union have rejected the results. The U.S. Secretary of State says that his country is ready to use a range of tools, including sanctions and visa restrictions, against what he's calling the Nicaraguan government's undemocratic acts. President Joe Biden has also accused Ortega of orchestrating, quote, a pantomime election that was neither free nor fair. Russia, on the other hand, is supporting Nicaragua and says the Western reactions are unacceptable. We earlier asked our correspondent in Managua, Ahmad Caballo, to weigh in on the results of the election in Nicaragua. He believes the re-election of President Ortega is the people's choice and that the U.S. is in no position to cast doubts on the country's electoral process.
There were people, long queues yesterday, waiting to vote. Today, there were Sandinista supporters celebrating. Yesterday, when we came back from the National Assembly at 4 a.m. in the morning, there were street parties with people with Sandinista flags celebrated. So it's very clear, and I've been here for 7 days now, that the president and the Sandinista movement is very popular. And the United States doesn't get to decide what is and isn't a fair election. There's many controversies over the recent election between Joe Biden and the former president Donald Trump. Yet Nicaragua doesn't call the election result illegitimate and pantomime elections. So what gives the United States the right to do the same? It is not the world police as it tries to present itself. And the other European allies, the European Union, the United Kingdom, these are all interested in breaking up what is considered the new non-aligned movement, which involves Iran, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cuba, Russia, China, countries that do not want to be dictated to by Washington.
Large caravan of migrants coming from Central America is now heading to the U.S. border rather than the originally planned Mexico City. The change in plans comes after reports of clashes with Mexican police forces and detentions in the past days. The caravan leaders say thousands of migrants are set to join the group later and set out for the border. The group, once as large as 4,000, began its journey 2 weeks ago. However, it has dwindled after walking for hundreds of kilometers through heat and clashes with migration officers. Washington is pressuring Mexico to contain them before they reach the U.S. Migration agents are increasingly using tough tactics to stem the influx. Israel has demolished three more Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank. The homes, located in a village west of the city of Bethlehem, were destroyed because Israel says that they were built without a permit. Meanwhile, the Palestinian Authority is warning that the Tel Aviv regime could soon move to demolish 20,000 Palestinian homes using the same excuse. The authority says the Israeli practice of forcing Palestinians from their homes has political motives. The demolitions have become a hallmark of Israeli policy. They're meant to change the demographics in the occupied territories by displacing Palestinians and making room for more settlements. Five European countries are questioning Israel's move to place six Palestinian human rights groups on a so-called terrorist list after a Security Council meeting on Monday. The Security Council remained silent on Tel Aviv's decision, but France, Estonia, Ireland, Norway, and Albania say that they will scrutinize the Israeli claims. Last month, Israel designated six Palestinian civil society groups as terrorist organizations. The move has drawn a lot of criticism from the UN and human rights watchdogs. The five European countries are also calling on Tel Aviv to end its settlement activities in the West Bank and East Al-Quds. They say that Israeli settlements are illegal under a Security Council resolution. New developments out of the southern province of Marib in Yemen. We're learning that a short while ago, the Yemeni air defenses shot down an unmanned spy drone in the airspace of Juba district there. Marib has been, for some time, a flashpoint of conflict between the Yemeni army and Ansarullah fighters on the one side and the mercenary forces supported by Saudi Arabia and the UAE on the other. Yemeni forces have been inching closer to fully liberating the province. They are already controlling the Juba district. That is the last area that was held by militias in the south of the strategic city of Marib. The Iranian army has wrapped up a massive maneuver in the strategic Strait of Hormuz, the Sea of Oman, and north of the Indian Ocean. The military exercise is aimed at boosting coordination between the four branches of Iran's military, Yusuf Jalali reports.
Senior military commanders parade and salute army soldiers as the last phase of a three-day maneuver, codenamed Zulfaqar 1400. The military exercise engaged the four branches of the Iranian army and was held over a million square kilometer area, stretching from the Strait of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf to the Sea of Oman and north of the Indian Ocean. Army commanders say the drill was a success and it carries regional and global messages.
The Islamic Republic has in recent years proved that it can be the axis of regional security, which entails a collective regional cooperation. If regional states join hands, they can protect the security of their region without the need to rely on foreigners. History has shown that foreign countries would never bring sustainable security to any nation.
The massive drill kicked off on Sunday with surface and subsurface vessels, air and naval flights, radars and missile systems. The Army also deployed its latest combat and reconnaissance drones, which are produced domestically. The Islamic Republic takes great pride in indigenizing its defense arsenal against the backdrop of an all-out sanctions regime by the U.S. that blocks Iran's access to even a bullet from other countries.
The Iranian army is prepared to confront any force that could possibly threaten Iran's territorial integrity and interests. Using our indigenous defense equipment, we are capable of defending our soil and will nip in the bud any threat from our enemies.
Situated in a geopolitically sensitive region, Iran holds regular drills as a means to enhance its preparedness in the face of possible threats, such as terrorism and piracy. Iran's armed forces have on different occasions underscored that the country will not be the first to pull the trigger, and its military doctrine is based on deterrence, not aggression.
The three-day military exercise wrapped up with important messages. On top of them is that Iran is strongly opposed to any foreign presence in the regional waters, describing it as destabilizing and provocative. The Iranian army says Iran and other regional countries are the ones that are responsible for ensuring the security of the region, and this means extraterritorial forces must go home. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drills.
Another Palestinian prisoner is facing a critical health condition after a prolonged hunger strike in objection to the Israeli jail system. Palestinian media say that Kayat Fasfus has been refusing to eat for 118 days now. He's among six inmates on lengthy and life-threatening hunger strikes against their indefinite detention. Hundreds of Palestinian administrative detainees have stopped eating in protest. They also complain about hostile jail conditions, including harassment and torture. The UN has expressed grave concern about the lives of the Palestinian hunger strikers. Administrative detention is illegal under international law, but Israel uses it to lock up Palestinians without charge or trial indefinitely. Mona Kandil is a correspondent joining us from occupied Ramallah to tell us more. So give us a quick summary about how many detainees we're talking about that were jailed illegally, and then in particular the conditions, from what I'm understanding, Fasfus is the one that may be suffering more than the others in terms of the hunger strike that he is on.
Well, yes, that's right. We are speaking today about 4,500 Palestinian prisoners are incarcerated in Israeli jails, including 450 Palestinian prisoners are held under the so-called administrative detention. It's a legal policy used by Israel to keep Palestinians behind bars without charge or trial. This is the reason why the six Palestinian prisoners who are on a hunger strike started to protest this illegal detention. They are demanding that the Israeli regime should either prosecute them or release them. They are saying they have the right to know what are the reasons behind keeping them behind bars. They have the right to know what are the charges against them. However, the Israeli regime refuses to say what are the charges. They claim that there are secret information that neither the prisoners nor their lawyers should know. We are speaking about six Palestinian prisoners have started their hunger strike. Kaid Al-Fasfous started refusing food 118 days ago. He was transferred to Israeli hospital several times, and then he was returned back to the prison clinic. He's in serious condition, threatening life condition. Human rights organizations are demanding the Israeli regime to immediately end his administrative detention and release him, because they are fearing, they fear that he might die anytime. There is also Miqdad Al-Qawasmi, who also had been on a hunger strike for 118 days as well. According to the doctors, he's not able to move, he's not able to talk or even to see. According to the doctors, the Israeli regime is refusing to deal with the legal demands of those prisoners. Advocacy groups say that it's not the first time Israeli prison authorities refuse to deal with the prisoners' demands or to end their administrative detention. They only do this when they feel that the hunger-striking prisoners would be on verge of death, and this is what's going on. But the issue doesn't stop here. Their suffering doesn't stop when they end their hunger strike, because the majority of the Palestinian prisoners, after this lengthy hunger strike, they continue to suffer even when they end their hunger strike and they are released by the Israeli regime. But experts are also saying that the Israeli jail authorities don't want other prisoners to follow in the footsteps of the hunger strikers. That's why they are trying to put them in a solitary confinement, or even to continue letting them suffer, because they don't want other prisoners to continue engaging in the hunger strike. Several days ago, thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails declared a one-day hunger strike in solidarity with the six Palestinian prisoners who have been on the hunger strike to protest the administrative detention.
Thank you for that, Monica Ndil. We appreciate it. Monica Ndil, correspondent there from Occupied Ramallah. The Taliban have launched a nationwide program in Afghanistan to cope with the growing poverty in the country. The program comes as most Afghans are suffering from food crisis due to the lack of foreign aid to the war-torn country. Rahmatullah Baghban reports from the Afghan capital, Kabul.
The Taliban government has launched its largest program to create new jobs and lessen the mass poverty in Afghanistan. Dig water channels in exchange for wheat. The program has been welcomed by the chief of World Food Program, David Beasley, who appreciated it as a good means to cope with the growing poverty in Afghanistan. The Taliban say the program will create tens of thousands of new jobs.
The program can create more than 40,000 short-term jobs. People will receive wheat in exchange for their work. The initiative will be expanded to other areas in future. The Taliban government is committed to tackle poverty in our country.
With the beginning of the program, thousands of people from across the capital, Kabul, have rushed toward this mountain to work for 10 days in exchange for 100 kilograms of wheat.
There have been no jobs for us over the past months. I lost my job after the government collapsed in August. Now, we have a job and receive wheat in exchange for our work. Today, we have something to eat.
I have been unemployed for 6 months. We are a family of seven. I'm unable to feed them as prices are increasing day by day. That's why I've come here to work. At least I can gain some wheat for my family.
In its latest report on Monday, WFP warned that hunger in Afghanistan is reaching its new peak, with 24 million people being pushed into acute hunger. The situation in Afghanistan remains dire as the foreign aid to the country has dried up. Prices are surging, and most importantly, the country's billions of dollars in reserves remain frozen. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The New Zealand government's coronavirus restrictions, including compulsory vaccinations, have angered many people there. Hours ago, the capital Wellington became the scene of a big protest against those policies. Thousands of people marched on Parliament. They held signs and chanted slogans, demanding a return to what they called the pre-pandemic freedoms. Unprecedented security measures were in place, and both entrances to the building were closed off. The government has changed its strategy from lockdowns to mandatory vaccination for all. New Zealand has largely fended off the pandemic with under 8,000 total cases and only 32 deaths. But the new Delta variant has raised concerns with 125 new cases reported on Tuesday. Grim new developments out of Europe, where more countries are registering record numbers of COVID deaths. That has raised fears that the continent may be back at the epicenter of the pandemic. Ukraine has lost a record figure of more than 830 people to the pandemic in the past 24 hours. That raises the total deaths to more than 73,000. Also nearly 19,000 new infections in the same period. And in Bulgaria, the daily fatalities hitting a record high of over 330 on Tuesday. This new cases have passed 5,000. Bulgaria is Europe's least vaccinated country. Just a day earlier, Germany, Russia, and Greece set near record levels of infections. Europe is reporting more than half of all new cases worldwide. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 2nd, 2021. On the occasion of the National Government Week, President Raisi and the cabinet members met with Imam Khamenei in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniyah during the first days after the formation of the 30th administration.
Well, there are other things to be said about economy as well. In my opinion, two points are important here. One is that in solving economic problems, we should not seek temporary solutions, painkillers, and the like. This is because such problems sometimes aggravate the issue. These painkillers and temporary cures sometimes worsen the situation. In order to overcome these challenges, we should think of fundamental solutions and begin to take firm steps by relying on God and by adopting good measures. The next point is that you should not make the resolution of these problems contingent upon the removal of sanctions. The removal of sanctions does not depend on us. It depends on others. Planning on the resolution of problems should be done by assuming that sanctions will be there. You should plan like this so that one can move the task forward.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
These problems should and will be resolved with your own determination and with your own jihadi effort. On the issue of culture and media, I believe that the cultural structure of the country needs a revolutionary reconstruction. We have a problem in the cultural structure of the country, and a revolutionary move is necessary there. Of course, revolutionary move means a wise and rational move. Being revolutionary does not mean moving rashly and ill-advisedly. The move should be revolutionary and fundamental, but at the same time, it should originate from thinking and wisdom. Culture is really an infrastructure. Some of the mistakes that we commit in different areas stem from the wrong culture that dominates our minds. If we consume extravagantly, if we copy others blindly, if we lead a wrong lifestyle, these result from cultural problems and from the culture ruling over minds.
In Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Saudi-led coalition seized three fuel tankers heading for war-torn Yemen nearly 3 months ago. On Saturday, Yemen's petroleum company put out a statement slamming the Saudi-led coalition's illegal confiscation of three oil ships carrying a collective amount of over 80,000 tons of diesel and preventing them from reaching the port of Hodeidah. Saudi Arabia still prevents vessels from docking in Hodeidah port despite them having received UN permits for sailing in international waters. Earlier this year, Yemen's Minister of Oil and Minerals, Ahmed Abdullah Daris, warned that the Saudi seizure of ships carrying petroleum products could lead to the suspension of the service sectors and cause a humanitarian catastrophe. The fuel blockade contributes to a much broader Saudi-led blockade campaign against Yemenis. The coalition's military forces have stopped planes from landing and ships from docking in Yemen. Many critics had prophesied that the blockade would keep much-needed food, fuel, medicine, and humanitarian aid from reaching desperate Yemenis, including millions of children. In fact, the World Food Program has estimated that around 400,000 Yemeni children under 5 are likely to die of starvation in 2021. That is nearly one child every 80 seconds. Also, over 16 million Yemenis are on the brink of acute starvation. That's almost half of the country's population. In March 2015, Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies, backed by the US, launched a war on Yemen. Their goal was to reinstate the friendly government of Abd Rabu Mansur Hadi and to eliminate the Ansarullah movement. However, so far they've failed, and the war has only left tens of thousands of people dead and millions more displaced.
There's been a history of the United Nations failing in the region, and as far away as 2016, the UK blocked a call for the establishment of an independent international inquiry. So we can see the United Nations is really controlled by members who have really no interest in the human rights of the people of Yemen.
The UN says more than 24 million Yemenis are in dire need of humanitarian aid, describing the country as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The ongoing fuel blockade against Yemen has led to food and medicine shortages. These items cannot be transported without fuel. Also, many hospitals experience power outages as they do not have enough power to keep the lights on amid the coronavirus pandemic. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden refuses to pressure Saudi Arabia into lifting the blockade on Yemen and stopping its deadly airstrikes. On the other hand, it tries to change the narrative in favor of the kingdom. For instance, Washington refuses to blame Riyadh for the current fuel shortage in Yemen. The U.S. says the Saudi coalition only blocks ships and planes that the Hadi government doesn't grant permission to. Therefore, it's the Hadi government that's imposing the blockade. But Washington's shameless support for Saudi Arabia doesn't end here. The Pentagon said the proposed sale of 280 advanced air-to-air missiles was approved by the State Department in late October. The deal is valued at up to $650 million. The missile sale follows the U.S. approval of a $500 million helicopter maintenance deal for the kingdom in September. The sale flatly contradicts Biden's sayings during the first major foreign policy speech of his presidency that the U.S. is ending its support for the Saudi-led bombing campaign in Yemen.
Well, some people believe that America's economy is built around merchandising death in general. The sale of $650 million recently, this week, to Saudi Arabia by the U.S. is really, from their position, the support of the U.S. foreign policy to the national security interests of the United States.
Yemen's Ansarullah movement has reacted to the new U.S. arms deal with Saudi Arabia, saying it proves Washington's continued support for Riyadh's warmongering and that the Biden administration has no real intention to stop the Saudi onslaught on Yemen. The arms supplies to Saudi Arabia have already sparked global criticism, given the kingdom's devastating war on Yemen since March 2015. But it seems the green Saudi dollars are worth a lot more to the U.S. than the lives of innocent Yemeni civilians and children.
Tensions are simmering in Ethiopia, where a year-long war between government forces and fighters of the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, is feared to intensify. The TPLF is the party ruling in the northern Tigray region. It used to hold power in Ethiopia until the parliamentary elections in 2018, when Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed took over with the support of country's largest ethnic groups, the Oromo and Amhara. On Friday, however, eight rebel groups, including the Oromo Liberation Front, agreed in Washington to join forces with the TPLF to form a coalition against the government, striking up an alliance between the historic foes.
The main reason why this alliance is significant is it's another example of them using this level of psychological warfare. This particular announcement, and what I would like to say grandiose event in D.C., coupled with the media's focus of the armies marching to the Capitol in the last few days, is just another way to create this level of manufactured consent from the people so they can feel as though, wow, well, the Ethiopian government is already lost, so I must try to put my hope into TPLF or this alliance in some case.
Ethiopia declared a nationwide state of emergency on the 2nd of November amid concerns that the forces, which are now within a day's drive from the capital Addis Ababa, may be considering attacking the city. The United Nations Security Council called for a halt to the fighting in Ethiopia on Friday, urging talks to end intensifying hostilities.
They further call to put an end to hostilities and to negotiate a lasting ceasefire and for the creation of conditions for the start of an inclusive Ethiopian national dialogue to resolve the crisis and create the foundation for peace and stability throughout the country.
The council members also expressed deep concern about the growing violence in northern Ethiopia. They urged the warring sides to refrain from inflammatory hate speech and incitement to violence. The council members also called for unhindered access for humanitarian aid and the reestablishment of public services, among others. The announcement of the alliance between 9 Ethiopian rebel groups in Washington coincided with the U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman's meeting with the Ethiopian Prime Minister amid calls for an immediate ceasefire and talks to end the war.
It's really interesting to note that TPLF has had a long-standing relationship to the U.S. and other European powers. I mean, the evidence here is, look at the ruling party within TPLF or the different officials and generals, and look at their assets and where they're stored.
The United Nations published a report this week that suggests both sides of the conflict have committed atrocities that may amount to war crimes. The conflict in the Tigray region erupted on November 4th last year when Ethiopia launched an offensive against the TPLF troops who allegedly attacked a federal army camp. The government declared victory at the end of November, but clashes have continued in the region. Soon after the start of the conflict, Eritrea, TPLF's longtime enemy, joined Ethiopia in attacking the rebels. The UN report suggests that Eritrean troops have also killed hundreds of civilians in Tigray in a matter of days. Due to a communications blackout and restricted access to the region for journalists, little is known about the extent of humanitarian crisis in the region. The fate of millions of Ethiopians is now hanging in the balance with no end in sight for their persecution in the absence of any meaningful international action.
Taiwan is an island in East Asia which has been self-ruled since 1950. The People's Republic of China regards it as a breakaway region that must one day be reunited with the mainland. Beijing has never ruled out the use of force to bring the island under its control. The situation has become very tense since President Tsai Ing-wen came into office in 2016. She has said Taiwan is independent and not part of China. The United States and some of its European allies have been expanding their relations with Taiwan despite Chinese opposition. The Chinese government has been angered by the growing trade and military ties between the West and Taiwan. In response to the West's growing support for the island, China has been flexing its military muscles in the region. Tensions escalated this week between the U.S. and China over Taiwan after America's top general signaled that America stands ready to intervene if a conflict erupts in the region. U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Mark Milley said the U.S. military absolutely could defend Taiwan from a potential Chinese attack if asked to do so. How far is the United States really willing to go over Taiwan? Will it be ready to confront another nuclear-armed superpower, given all the risks and possible costs involved, where success is not guaranteed at all?
This sounds very much like typical political positioning before some sort of a negotiation. The United States certainly does not have any positive interest in making a war over Taiwan, except, of course, to sell weapons and to spend taxpayers' money.
Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin said on Thursday that, quote, the negative and erroneous words and deeds of the U.S. related to the Taiwan question have encouraged the blatancy of the Taiwan secessionists. He also blamed Washington for the increasing tension across the Taiwan Strait. Beijing has reiterated that the issue of Taiwan is a red line that must not be crossed, but the West seems to be determined to challenge China. This week, the European Parliament's first official delegation to the island said Taiwan is not alone and called for measures to bolster EU-Taiwan ties. Beijing condemned the trip, urging the European side to correct its mistakes and not send any wrong signals to Taiwan, warning that it will harm China-EU relations. Where does Europe really stand on this issue?
The Europeans are typically following Germany and making supportive sounds in the support of U.S. foreign policy, but are not prepared to physically become engaged, especially after the debacle in Afghanistan. So I would suggest that we can call the European comments on this topic chatter on the line. In other words, a background noise that's not critical to the situation.
The EU seems to be following policies close to those of the U.S. The West knows all too well that China is highly unlikely to back down on the issue of Taiwan. Why is it then being so provocative? Is it trying to create a conflict in the region close to China's borders? The U.S. has been selling many billions of dollars worth of weapons to the self-ruled island. And U.S. President Joe Biden has made no secret of his priority to contain China's influence. This leaves little doubt that Taiwan will remain a very serious bone of contention between the two sides for years to come.
Forces of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, have managed to thwart an attempt by the United States to take over a giant oil tanker in the strategic sea of Oman. The U.S. military confiscated the Iranian tanker loaded with crude oil in the Sea of Oman, intended to unload the shipment to another tanker and then direct it to an unknown destination. But IRGC forces reacted promptly and carried out a heli-borne operation the stolen ship's deck, gained control of the vessel, and directed it back toward Iran's territorial waters. U.S. forces then proceeded to chase the tanker, using several helicopters and warships, but their attempt at taking over the vessel for a second time was thwarted again by Iranian naval forces. The tanker is currently in Iranian territorial waters and under the protection of IRGC's Navy.
The United States continues to use oil and weaponize oil against Iran, because it has not been able to overthrow the Iranian Islamic Revolution in any other way.
Iran has repeatedly warned the U.S. about its military adventurism in the Persian Gulf. Tehran says it has increased its patrols to secure the passage of Iranian ships and to combat fuel smuggling in the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman.
The U.S. will try to provoke some sort of conflict in the Persian Gulf because of this, and we have to keep this in mind because the Persian Gulf belongs to Iran and people of the Middle East, not the United States. The United States should not be there to begin with.
Iranian officials say U.S. military presence in the region is a source of instability and insecurity. Iran believes the countries of the region are fully capable of providing their own security. The latest confrontation between the U.S. and Iran comes amid rising bilateral and regional tensions.
The United States continues its presence in the Persian Gulf because it is a key geopolitical trade route. Most of the energy, commerce, petroleum, commodities that are exchanged on the global market are done so in the Persian Gulf, because if we look geographically at a map, the Persian Gulf connects trade in Europe across Egypt through the Suez Canal and leads into the Indian Ocean
Washington has tried to disrupt the legitimate oil trade of Iran with other countries. The U.S. has threatened Iran over its fuel deliveries to Lebanon and Venezuela. It believes that the sanctions it has imposed on Iran should be adhered by Iran under its so-called maximum pressure campaign. But this is a campaign that has failed, even admitted by some U.S. officials. Tensions have risen between Iran and the U.S. after the U.S. pulled out of the 2015 nuclear deal. The U.S. left the deal as part of a so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. The campaign included tough economic sanctions combined with credible military threat. Washington's European allies failed to live up to their commitments.
For many years, since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, the United States, Washington, London, the Western imperialist powers have done everything they can to try to overthrow the popular revolution, the government.
The administration of U.S. President Biden says it wants to rejoin the deal, but at the same time, it is pressing ahead with failed maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. The secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council has also said in a tweet that the talks to remove sanctions on Iran would fail unless U.S. President Joe Biden could guarantee that Washington would not renege on the nuclear agreements in the future.
And the U.S. maintains its presence in the Persian Gulf because it sees that Iran has been able to withstand so many imperialist attacks, and also that Iran has many friends around the world. Let's recall, just a few weeks ago, in the lead up to this piracy by the U.S., that Iran was able to successfully bring petroleum refineries to the nation of Venezuela.
Now, talks have been set to resume on November 29th, but the talks are aimed at removing illegal U.S. sanctions imposed on Iran. That is Iran's approach towards the talks. Only time will tell whether the U.S. will remove the sanctions or that the talks will fail.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Stand here so unafraid of everything around me. Proudly, I would say I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way? All covered up in a world that gives it all away. Proudly, she would say I am a Muslim.
Islamic law.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jalad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Talk about the unlawful gains, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Let's take a listen to a short biography, and we'll be back.
little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Tawrid, since we are talking about Islamically unlawful gains, what is the ruling about the income made from selling some unlawful foodstuff, among other goods, in a cooperative, especially when it is destined to be distributed among the shareholders?
Do you mean that the income is going to be distributed, yes?
Yes.
Among the shareholders, of course. You know, it is haram to buy and sell the foodstuff, or the foodstuffs, of course, that are haram for human consumption,
yes,
as we discussed it in one of the previous episodes. And, of course, if it is sold or bought for such purpose, the sale transaction is definitely right, you know. Such a transaction is basically impermissible. And, of course, the proceeds made in the process is definitely haram, of course. The proceeds, the money that you get from the sale of such things is obviously haram according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And therefore, it's not permissible to distribute the proceeds among the shareholders. Now you have, for example, you receive something after selling these haram stuff or food stuff. You have sold, let's say, 20 kilos of rice and 10 bottles of alcoholic beverages, okay?
Yes.
So it means that you have sold haram and halal things, both halal and haram things together.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as far as the proceeds received for the 10 bottles of alcoholic beverages, of course, the proceeds are haram, and it cannot be distributed among the shareholders. And Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that if the property of the cooperative is tainted with this illicit money, now if it gets mixed with this illicit money, the ruling of property mixed with haram is applicable. You know, we know that if a property is mixed with haram, we know what to do. We have to obviously purify it by giving 1/5 of it as khums. And that's how you can make it pure, make it halal for yourself to use.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay. Another question would be about finding jobs in some centers, such as hotels, for example, in non-Muslim countries. And you know how hard it is actually these days to find a job. And sometimes part of the job description is that you do, in fact, do such activities which are required, or some of the services you need to offer in those centers. For example, if you're a hotelier, the owner asks you to serve alcoholic drinks, for example, to the customers. And if you don't do that, then you'll be dismissed from that job.
It will have consequences.
Exactly. So, or the customers would not go to the hotel if you just, you know, refuse to do so. Well, and it is to be noted, however, that the businessman, the owner, for example, intends to dispose all the profit made on the unlawful food and drink, all right? The income basically generated from the unlawful gains. By giving to the authorized religious authority, is it permissible for him to do so?
Well, it doesn't make any difference whether the money which comes from halal source is given to a religious authority or anyone else. Of course, it's not permissible to involve in giving haram food stuff like pork, or serving the customers alcoholic beverages.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Ayatollah Khamenei, may Allah grant him long life, says that there is no problem in doing business as a hotelier, okay?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Or as a person who keeps a restaurant, who you know runs a restaurant in a non-Muslim country. But at the same time, of course, he says that it is not permissible to sell haram foodstuff and haram drink. Even if we know for sure that the person who comes to the hotel is a non-Muslim, so it does not make any difference. And even if the consumer is a non-Muslim, and of course the money is not permissible to receive either. You know, if you sell alcoholic beverages or pork or whatever haram stuff that you want to sell to the consumer, then the money is not halal to receive, even if you intend to hand over the profit made to a religious authority.
Uh-huh.
So no matter what the situation, you cannot run such a business, okay? Of course, even Ayatollah Khamenei says that if the franchise is segregated, and if it is run by someone else, and but the hotel or the restaurant is run in partnership with someone else, again, the income, there is problem or there is objection in the money received by you.
I see. Thank you very much. Let's take another break and we'll be back.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We are still talking about Islamic gain, unlawful gains, according to the fatwas of Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, I've got two questions which are very much or pretty much related, and they have something to do with the seafood. Let me ask you the first one, and then we'll get back to the second question then.
Sure.
The first one is, what's the Islamic law on the scaled fish, which dies inside the fishing nets.
Oh, well, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, of course, scale fish which dies inside fishing nets of a fisherman, of course, is halal. He does say that is halal in a clear fatwa. He says that is halal. No,
inside the water.
It does not die inside the water. You know, when the net is pulled out, then it squeezes the fish to the extent that some fish get actually suffocated.
Yes.
So it actually dies out of the
water.
Out of the water. And of course,
that's the only criterion, right, for the fish,
yeah,
the scale fish to be halal.
That's the main reason. That's the main criterion. In order for the fish to be halal, it should die out of the
water.
Out of the water.
Yes.
And of course, the fishing net usually is out of the water as long as it, you know, when the fishing net is spread under the water, it is no fish is going to die. Because it does not squeeze the fishes together, the fish together.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's pulled out, there is pressure, there is, you know, the fish are squeezed, and some fish end up dying in the net, and others die on board the ship. So in either case, the fish is halal.
Mm-hmm. And then last question, is it allowed to buy or sell inedible water animals? Can we also sell them to people who consider eating them lawful, Islamically, halal? Is it permissible to trade in them for purposes other than human consumption, such as bird, animal feed, or manufacturing them?
Good question. Well, it's not permissible, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, to sell or buy any of the types which are not sanctioned for human consumption.
Mm-hmm.
No, there are different species in the sea which are not allowed to consume. Okay. But, okay, even there are, of course, maybe some Muslim sects, some Muslims who do not follow the Shia school of jurisprudence, but they might still consume them. And non-Muslims categorically, of course, do consume those species.
Yes.
But it does not become a license for me as a Shia Muslim to trade and to engage in selling them.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, because they are basically forbidden according to the Shia Islam. Okay, as far as the scaled fish is concerned, as I said, it's permissible to sell, it's permissible to buy. But of course, such species which are hunted or caught from the sea and brought out onto the shore, they can be used for some other purposes. Okay, like they can be used for in medicine, and they can be used in manufacturing and feeding birds and animals. Okay, there are birds which consume fish or which eat fish, and of course, if those fish are brought out for these purposes, then there's no doubt that it is permissible, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, to sell them, to buy them, and to engage in trading such species for those purposes.
I see.
Like feeding and animals, birds, and of course manufacturing things
okay.
or medicine things.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.